You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Juliana Lamy is a Haitian writer from South Florida. She received her bachelor's degree in history and literature from Harvard University and is currently pursuing a master's in creative writing at the Iowa Writers Workshop. Her forthcoming short story collection, titled You Are Watching from the Sand, deploys elements of speculative fiction to describe poignant and sometimes magical moments in the lives of Haitians. It's always lyrical and alternatingly humorous, tender, playful, and devastating. To kick us off, I'd like to read a short excerpt from the collection's titular story. You were born on one of those days where the sky won't break apart for the rain, where the sky won't break apart for the sun. You were born on one of those days where everybody's bone tired, where sleep drags through them and replaces the blood, and all the branches of exhaustion the river empty out inside their stomachs, when everybody has a lake with them, right under the heaven of their ribs. Those days where you could drown if you stayed too long inside yourself. Welcome, Juliana. Thank you for talking with me today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So to get us started, I'd like you to just tell the listeners a bit about yourself as a writer. Who and what has inspired or influenced you, and how have those influences and inspirations helped to shape this collection?
So I've been writing basically since I could hold a pencil with my little hands. But I think that I started seriously writing and considering fiction about 4 years ago when I was still an undergrad. At that time, I was reading a lot of Toni Morrison more seriously. I was reading a lot of Viet Thanh Nguyen. When The Sympathizer came out, I was very, very obsessed. And I was also thinking a little bit more deeply about Haitian myth and Haitian folklore. Now with Toni Morrison and Viet Thanh Nguyen, I think that it's sort of reading their novels kind of gave me the permission to kind of pursue the lyrical exuberance that I've always really, really admired. So that's sort of like what I'm striving to in a lot of my writing now. And then just like the considerations of Haitian myth kind of really influenced the, I would say particularly the voices of a lot of the stories that I write, as well as just sort of the, the particular cadences. And I think that currently I'm also working a lot more with actual parts of Haitian language. So in some of the stories in this collection and some of the stories that I'm working on outside of this collection, there are more sort of moments where there are Haitian words that are untranslated. But it's sort of like that combination of lyrical exuberance that I've kind of like taken from a lot of from much of the sympathizer, much of Tan Nguyen's work, and then pretty much all of Toni Morrison's Au Revoir has been just a huge influence on me as well.
That's funny. Viet Thanh Nguyen was actually, he spoke alongside Natasha Trethewey for my graduate program just the week before. Yeah, it was really cool. And he actually, the two of them had a discussion and sort of inspired this next question. So thank you so much for the perfect lead-in. So I'm curious if you can describe, you know, how did you come to write short fiction rather than, say, a novel or a poetry collection? Why short fiction?
Yeah, so I let me just preface this question by saying that I've always wanted to be a poet. It's one of my most deeply kept secrets because I'm in a fiction program. But I think that I've always sort of admired just the kind of just phenomenal distillation of meaning that poetry relies on, and just sort of that attention to form. I think that sort of even now, currently, I'm still kind of intimidated by that process of distillation. But I really, really love sort of the I really, really love sort of the space that fiction offers me in sort of pursuing the interest that I have, particularly in language, and just sort of the flexibility of narrative. I think that I have tried to write poetry. I don't think I've ever finished a poem. I think the way that I would describe it is that I move a lot better in fiction, in sort of that fictive space. There's just there's so much of that space. And then too, I think that particularly the sort of my decision to focus on short fiction for now rather than the novel is because I think that I wasn't, I'm not really sort of ready for the expansiveness that the novel requires. But also I have, I think that I have a kind of a very short attention span when it comes to story premises right now. So sort of as soon as I finish, or as soon as I come up with a story premise, I'm already thinking of another story premise that's kind of hanging on to the previous one. And I kind of I want to start it immediately. So I think that for now, this short fiction is the perfect kind of the perfect avenue for me. But yes, and additionally, I think that also a lot of the stories that I write, I like to describe it as sort of every single story that I write has a series of kind of little doors that lead to other stories. So even though they're not, the stories in this collection are not connected to one another in a literal narrative sense, they are kind of connected to each other in the sense that they've inspired each other. And hopefully you can sort of see the influence that they've each had on each other in this collection, the way that they cohere.
I definitely think you can.
I think they can. Wonderful.
So I wanted to talk with you about the way that you use language, because I think it's really striking and that it's beautiful. At times it's really playful. At times it's quite blunt and sort of haunting. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about how you think of language as a writer and how you deploy language in this collection.
Yeah. I love talking about language and fiction. It can go on, but I think that for me particularly, my entry point into any story is always sonics, just sort of the sound of things, how things sound. I think that is sort of what allows me access into the sensory landscape of a story. So in order for me to sort of get to the visuals of a story, in order for me to get to the smells of a story or anything tactile in a story, it has to start with sound. Just sort of how do the characters in this piece speak? How does the sound of water running in the story sound? So I think that I'm particularly thinking of that. And also I think that in all of these stories, I really try to kind of recreate the cadence of Haitian Creole, particularly kind of the way that I'm trying to sort of put this into words, but sort of the the way that there's always just kind of like this like very distinct wittiness running through every phrase in Haitian Creole. I'm trying to kind of recreate that in a lot of these stories. Sort of like that quickness of mind and quickness of language I'm trying to sort of recreate. So those are sort of like some of the ways that I'm thinking of language in this collection.
Thank you. So the other thing I wanted to talk about that you use sort of in this collection is, I don't think all of the stories are using speculative elements, but certainly many of them are. And so I was wondering if you could sort of describe, you know, what is it about speculative fiction or the sort of what that genre or supergenre allows that you were interested in using? And I know when we talked previously before the interview, we talked about magical realism. So maybe if you could kind of walk us through like how you think of magical realism or speculative fiction more broadly and why it is that you chose to deploy elements of those in your writing.
Yeah. So magical realism. So it's a very, very long tradition. And obviously I'm not about to say anything too original, but I think that for me, sort of like the kind of like what I've kind of distilled from a lot of the definitions that I've heard of magical realism and the way that I've seen it operating in a lot of my favorite novels is that I really, really, really like the definition of that term that talks about how reality has to accommodate the fantastical. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like you, sort of the fantastical is entering into these realms that we're already used to. And sort of like you see kind of reality having to meld around that. So I think that first and foremost in any speculative piece that I'm writing, the speculative element is always, the most significant part. It's what I start with. And then also in terms of sort of what speculative fiction allows me to do, I think that I was thinking about this really deeply when I took a fiction workshop with Kevin Brockmeyer, who I really, really admire. So in that workshop, we were obviously thinking a lot about, you know, what speculative fiction allows us to do, and particularly the way that speculative fiction allows for kind of like this emotional expansiveness, and sort of like the way that speculative fiction allows for emotional reactions to be kind of actualized and literalized on the page. So instead of sort of, you know, just having a character who's angry, you have a character who's so angry that they transform into, you know, a volcano or something like that. So I'm just really, really, I just love that, that just sort of like, that pursuit of the literal in service of the emotional. I've always really, yeah, I'm still like stunned by it. I love it.
That's such a great way of putting it. I just love that. And I think it leads really perfectly into my next question, which is obviously you're using, you're sort of playing on myths throughout the collection. And so I wonder like, if you could talk about what kinds of myths inspire you or inform your work, what is important about myth sort of generally to you and also in your writing?
Yes. So I don't know if this is cringy to say, but I am of the Percy Jackson generation. So
I don't think that's cringy.
So I very like just been raised in this like crucible of like Greek myth obsession. And I've always just been very, very fascinated by Greek myth. I think that particularly one of the stories in this collection, Belly, is a loose retelling of the Pygmalion myth. So I think that so Greek mythology figures very kind of prominently, I think, because it's one of the first kind of like one of the first traditions of myth that I was that I consciously remember being exposed to, but it's obviously not the first. So Haitian folklore has like a very kind of extensive history of myth and of those sorts of stories. So I think that even though I've kind of like always been exposed to those myths, it was kind of a as I got older, I kind of had to return to the stories that I had been hearing all of my life. I don't think I ever kind of fully internalized them as myth on par with Greek mythology, unfortunately, until I got much, much older. So we have a lot of, and this is true of a lot of kind of Afrocentric, African descended cultures, but a lot of our myths center around trickery and sort of like getting one over on other people. So I think that a lot of sort of like that, that like those moments of like sleight of hand or trickery or interacting with people in that way. I think that I've been sort of, more incorporating those elements of myth into my work as well.
I think that, that sort of trickster character runs through quite a few of the stories, and it's so delightful to read. I just love it. I also wanted to talk about the importance of time in your writing, because I noticed you're doing some really interesting things with time. So, for example, in the story Eli, your narrator protagonist is constantly playing with the meaning of time, linking the present and the past, the moment sort of unfolding with the memory. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what time means for you in your writing and how you're interested in playing with time in the way that you do.
So I think that I've always been really, really interested in the simultaneity of moments, so like occurrences happening at exactly the same time. I think that I've always been kind of interested in a very like non-scientific way in quantum physics, kind of like a leisurely interest more. So that sort of idea of things happening constantly at the same time. And I've always been sort of interested in the way that that memory kind of rests inside of people and sort of influences our present. So I think that I try to recreate a lot of that in my stories and in the page. I think that in a lot of... this isn't really true of this collection, but I think that in my experience of writing now, I have these very, very kind of extended moments of memory, very extended moments of backstory. And I think that it's kind of can you hear me?
Sorry. You sort of cut out. So if you wouldn't mind just going back just a beat.
Oh, yes. So in my current writing outside of this collection, I've had much more of a focus on backstory and sort of extended moments of memory, which has kind of been a nightmare for people who are in workshop with me, sort of like trying to like pare down those moments. But the thing is that what's happening in my mind is that these moments of memory, they kind of feel... they are present tense to me. I think that currently I write a lot of these like past tense moments in present tense. I write a lot in present tense in general, but memory particularly has been much more of a present tense endeavor for me. And I think that it started particularly with this collection, with the way that I kind of like, I want moments in the past and moments in the present, and even sometimes moments in the future to stand side by side by side.
Thank you for talking about that. I love that we're in the current class that I'm co-teaching, the undergrads are reading Octavia Butler's Kindred. And so we've been having a lot of discussions about, the sort of present in the past and how memory unfolds and how time works the way it does. And so, I think the way you've just articulated that, maybe some of them will listen to this interview. It can help them out. So another theme that sort of winds through the stories is water. For instance, in the opening of the story you were watching from the sand, which I quoted at the beginning of this interview, there are all these references to water, including exhaustion, the river. You write about Christopher Columbus landing on Hispaniola, which of course conjures the image of the sea. And you write about a person as a body of water on which Ivy League colleges could be, quote, so heavy that they're not going to float, that they could never keep themselves above the surface, end quote, of a person, but rather that they'd sink to the bottom. So water in this story and in others, it seems very important. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit about how you're using water to create meaning in this story in particular, perhaps, or in the collection more generally.
So let me just start off by saying that I have a deep and abiding fear of open water. I think that... the ocean is very scary. And I think that I'm just sort of like very kind of fascinated by it as sort of like this avenue of like terror, ultimately, but that's like mostly my own bias, this avenue of terror, but also this avenue of conveyance, and sort of like the way that that transport kind of operates. I think that I was thinking about that, the way that kind of movement operates, and the way that I kind of like wanted to mess with the notion of movement within a static body, which shows up in that opening excerpt of You Were Watching from the Sand, the title story. I think also I am also kind of I've always been kind of fascinated by water as someone sort of like who comes from an island, and sort of like the kind of like communal, kind of like the communal Haitian, like the communal Haitian impression of the ocean, and sort of like the way that it is, you know, sort of like this this element of this very essential element of life, because fishing is a very very big like part of Haitian culture, but also sort of like this this like genuine element, or this genuine sort of like vector for fear and for mourning, because of just the sheer amount of of Haitian people who have drowned in the Caribbean Sea while trying to get from Haiti to other countries or to other places. So I think that I just like, I have a very, very complicated relationship with the open sea. There's also just something so, there's also just been something so absolutely remarkable about it as well. I think that, I've also been thinking about the ocean sea, or like the open sea, and the ocean, in terms of Haitian mythology, and in terms of voodoo mythology, particularly, because there's sort of like this this belief in voodoo that when you know a person dies, they kind of sort of descend to the bottom of the ocean, and they kind of await their time to sort of be taken to the other side. So I think that. Yeah, so I think that as I've gotten older, there's kind of like this bit, there's been this evolution in my thinking about water, from that point of terror, which I still have, to that point of really like sort of expansive and really distinct folklore and cultural significance.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
That's so fascinating, and it just makes me want to go back and reread the whole collection. I feel like I'll have such a deeper, sort of more complex understanding of those stories now. So thank you.
Of course.
So I did want to talk about the story titled The Oldest Sensation is Anger, because yes. I absolutely love this story. And it's so funny that you say that Toni Morrison is an inspiration, because when I was reading this, I was thinking about my favorite book of all time, Sula, because of this, like, I don't know, beautifully sort of complex and playful, and I don't even know what else sort of relationship between these two main characters. It's like so rich and fascinating. So could you tell us a little bit about this story and how you sort of capture this really interesting and beautiful relationship between the two main characters?
Yeah, so I'm so excited to talk about this story. I know that, so I feel like I shouldn't have a favorite like story or favorite quote unquote child, but like this is my favorite child. And thank you. Yeah, thank you. I'm so kind of flattered and humbled by the comparison to Sula. I love that novel. I think that with particularly The Oldest Sensation is Anger, I was trying to write kind of my own version of the Haitian zombie myth. I think that it's not sort of Shay, that title character who's supposed to be the quote unquote zombie. It's never really kind of explicit that is what she is, that her transformations are kind of shrouded in mystery. But I think that I was I was definitely thinking about the Haitian zombie myth as I was writing that story. And also particularly the way that with the Haitian zombie myth, one of the biggest horrors of being turned into a zombie is that you actually do retain portions of your consciousness. I know that in a lot of sort of like Western iterations of the zombie, you completely lose your consciousness and you're kind of sort of like this mindless, hungry figure. But in Haitian zombieology, is that a word? I'm not sure. you do kind of retain portions of your consciousness, which is why that not sort of like being able to be in complete control of yourself is so potently horrifying. But I wanted to kind of like flip that on its head and have Shay be sort of like completely conscious, completely aware of her consciousness, but still kind of like possess those those strange elements of like of bodily transformation, which I have to be honest, I am kind of like borrowing from Western iterations of the zombie. Shay is not like strictly a Haitian zombie, but by the strictest definitions of the word. But as I was writing the character, I was just very, very excited to think about the concept of the zombie so extensively. And then also I feel like it's a very big literary thing to have these very like codependent relationships. So I want to write a codependent relationship. So Shay and Nadia are sort of my iteration of that. I was just sort of like fascinated by the ways that kind of obsession builds and builds between individuals, and it's not necessarily romantic, but there is sort of like that kind of like that fixation there. As I was writing them, I was constantly just like, how can I render this sort of connection between two people and make it clear that it is sort of like almost like it creepily intimate as they can get to one another. So I was very kind of fascinated by that.
I love that. Yeah. Creepily intimate. It's just like, I think that's a great description. No wonder you're the one who wrote it. It's just fantastic. So I want to go back to what you said sort of about like the Western zombie myth versus like the Haitian zombie myth, because yes, there's this really fascinating point in this story. Obviously, like, yeah, she's not like eating bodies, right? But she does have this like desire that you write about Nadia, the other character. She's described as wanting more bodies and hoping that each person that she's had this particular kind of sexual encounter with carry some part of her, you write, condensed inside of them. So I just want to read this quick quote. So Nadia has this desire to, quote, come out of their abdomens, skin of their bellies, hiked up like skirts to release her, end quote. And yeah, so there is this kind of like creepy, like grotesqueness, this desire to stick with people, to like accumulate bodies, that does give like Nadia herself this sort of like maybe more Western zombie-ish feel now that I'm thinking about it. But I wonder if you could just sort of talk us through this, because I think this is really fascinating, this desire for this desire for more bodies, for sort of sticking on the skin of others and making our contacts with them last. So I guess, like, if you could speak to that, and then maybe, I know this is like maybe a meandering and not too big questions, but just sort of like how bodies generally, how you're kind of thinking about them and working with them in the stories.
Yeah. So I think that particularly with the section that you just read, it kind of brings me to the headspace that I was in when I wrote Nadia as a character. And the fact is that she is, I think, like the loneliest character I've ever written, which is saying a lot because a lot of my characters are very lonely. But yeah, so I wanted to sort of like see, I think that her kind of like desire to kind of like stick to people once they have left her was me kind of trying to literalize and actualize her loneliness on the page. This desire to constantly be on the minds or like in within the considerations of pretty much anyone or anyone that she has been in contact with. I think that as I was thinking of this desire of hers to be sort of like on other people's minds, I was sort of like, maybe it's not enough to have her desire that, you know, people think about her. Maybe I need to go further with this. And I think that sort of like speaking more broadly, like particularly like with bodies and the human body, the body is just like such a really, really like always like effective and potent way of making so many more watery emotional impulses feel more solid and real. So I think that is where my instinct immediately told me to go. And I think that's true too of Lee in Belly, which is another story in the collection, and the character who creates Lee from the mud is also a very lonely character, but the sort of way that Lee is essentially Lee is definitely their own character and possesses their own consciousness, but Lee is also essentially a capturing and an encapsulation of that title character's loneliness as well. So I think that particularly with bodies, I think that I have a very kind of speculative thinking with them, and the way that, the emotional is kind of allowed to be kind of solidified and cemented in things that we can touch and actually feel.
Yeah, it feels like when you say that this is like, yeah, how you're thinking about this sort of speculatively, that totally makes sense. I think with something that you said at the beginning of the interview, which I thought was really great, which is that like the speculative sort of demands that reality accommodate, I think is the word that you use, right? Like what's happening in the story. And yeah, so I think that's what sort of Nadia is doing here as well, is like demanding a kind of like accommodation for a desire that doesn't really necessarily like work in reality, right? But
yeah,
but maybe it does a little bit in this story with the relationship that she has with Shay. So the last question that I wanted to ask you about like a specific story was thinking about the story Wynwood, which is I think is so lovely, and it has definitely like these explicit queer themes and characters, but that happens also, that's existing in other stories, sometimes explicitly, sometimes maybe more implicitly. But in Wynwood, we've got this protagonist who's a young queer man or a teenager who is constantly finding that when people look at him, they are seeing someone else that they have some desire, good or bad, to see. So I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit about the relationship of this character to his boyfriend, Nico, in comparison to perhaps like his relationship with his family members and their sort of, I don't know, you like misuse of his face or his desires, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, so I think that I've been thinking a lot about queerness within the Haitian community as, you know, these like these very disturbing pieces of legislation have been cropping up around specifically targeting trans people. And then I've also been thinking a lot about Asato Saint, who was, you know, obviously this very queer, like this very iconic queer Haitian figure, in particularly in the New York scene. I think that I've been sort of thinking about how essential and how sort of like life-saving it is for particularly queer Haitians to be able to kind of flicker in and out of sight. It's absolutely crucial that they have control over, you know, sort of like who they're visible to and who they're invisible to. And sort of like the inability to control that can lead to their death, to their murders. And I was thinking about that flickering in and out of sight, but I kind of wanted to think about sort of what if the queerness wasn't sort of what if I could kind of like separate what if the queerness wasn't sort of like an avenue for the death of that queer person who is unable to control who they're visible and invisible to. What if the kind of like the queerness was the refuge, which is the reason why I kind of have those two characters at the end of the story. I have my title character and I have Nico kind of like in that sort of moment of intimacy in Nico's room. But I sort of wanted to see if I could kind of, if I can turn that flickering into something that is something that did not result in sort of like the death or the sort of like the mutilation of a queer person because specifically of the queerness, because of their inability to control the who they're visible or invisible to. And then relatedly, I wanted to kind of have fun with the notion of being kind of like being visible or invisible to people in ways that you kind of like entirely cannot control at all, kind of like being this kind of blank slate for a lot of people. I thought that was so fascinating. I think I have a reference to Nicolas Cage in that story, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes, I loved it. Yeah.
Yes, the no face man. Yeah. So I was also thinking about that as well. But I know that I said that The Oldest Sensation is Anger is my my favorite child, but I think that Wynwood is definitely my Miami baby. Yeah, I really love that story.
Well, I'm really glad that we got the chance to talk about both of them, and I so appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. So my final question is, when can people buy your book and where from?
Yes. So my collection will be published on September 19th of this year, 2023. And it can be purchased on redhen.org. Let me pull up the list because I always forget. I'm so sorry. So yes, it can be purchased on redhen.org, bookshop.org, indiebound.org, barnesandnoble.com, and amazon.com. And it's actually already available for pre-order.
Awesome. All right. Well, listeners, you need to go pre-order this wonderful book. And thank you again, Juliana, for talking with me today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This was lovely.